supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family. Today's show's about humor. No, seriously, it's really about humor, and we're glad to have the chance to talk about laughter with comedian Bob Saget, who is from Philadelphia, by the way, graduate of Abington High. He became hugely famous for his role in the TV sitcom Full House during the late 80s and 90s, and then on a show he hosted for years called America's Funniest Home Videos. Now he is just as well known for his racy stand-up act. He's just written a memoir called Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a TV Dad Turned Filthy Comedian. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I've got a question just between you and me. Your publicist said that you wanted to be alone with me for the first half of the show. And I did some research, and I found your bar mitzvah picture.
Yeah.
Which looked remarkably like my bar mitzvah picture.
Were you feeding your parents cake like I was?
Exactly.
Right.
And my late sister always told me that I was adopted. So it's the whole combination of things with the pictures and the adoption. And
so you're wondering if we're separated at birth?
I'm wondering.
Yeah, it's the genetics around that area are very similar. I would find someone from Cheltenham or Abington that could have been from the same litter.
Speaking of Abington High,
right.
And then I'll get to the interview in a minute. There was another really funny guy that graduated from Abington High. That was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Did he really graduate from
Honest, there? Honest to God, he really did.
Yeah. Wow, I did not know that. I was in the presence of greatness. All I knew that there was a hospital nearby, Abington Hospital, that I had my hand sewn up. I didn't know that Netanyahu graduated.
Yeah, and he was, I'm sure he'd be thrilled to hear that Bob Saget graduated.
Was it spelled exactly the same? Are you sure it was him or just had the same
no,
name?
No, it was him. It was BB. He graduated from your alma mater. So
interesting. Right. I had an amazing teacher there, Elaine Zimmerman. Did you know her?
No, but I was going to talk about her because you just screwed up my whole interview. She was at
I'm sorry.
End of the
you
interview.
You want to start at
here.
The back?
Yeah, well, now
we can do it like the Talmud.
Now we have to start at the back. So it's about your mentors that I wanted to talk about.
Cause right.
We did a show on wisdom, and some of your mentors were George Carlin, Rodney Dangerfield, Don Rickles,
mm-hmm.
and, of course, Elaine Zimmerman. Did they
yeah.
all have wisdom?
Yeah, they had different kinds of wisdom. She was an English teacher, and her wisdom was that she, as all great teachers, recognized someone as wacky as me had potential and told me not to be a doctor. I was going to go pre-med. I took pre-med classes to tee up possibly doing that at Temple University. And she said, don't do that, become a doctor. And, don't do that, become a comedian. Sorry.
Wow.
It is backwards day, the beginning of this interview, but it's going to go completely forwards.
For this
she told me to
right.
be a comic, and the punchline was that she saved thousands of lives because I would have not. People would have perished under my scalpel.
Yeah, yeah. You talked about how much you loved and admired your dad, and
yeah.
how much he taught you, and yet you said you never really got to know him as a person until you were late. Teens. It's not real unusual.
How about yourself? Did you know my father?
I did. And
you knew my dad.
I didn't get to know him until his late teens.
Right. So it was the same thing. So he didn't make himself open to his own son or strangers' sons
right.
until they were older boys.
Yeah. So what happened in your late teens? In his late teens?
I think he had been working so hard for a company that was Food Fair Pantry Pride Supermarkets, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and I was a deli clerk. And he once I started to have a work ethic, he started to get involved a little more in my life. He didn't do a lot. I had two older sisters. He didn't do homework with us. He just worked all the time, trying to keep the company doing well. He was a very conscientious guy. It was the opposite of a Willie Loman type of career. And he was, I'd say in this book that I've written, that he's a hero of mine. And he was, because no matter what, he just had his eye on taking care of his life. Yeah. Wasn't always healthy for him. But then when I was older, when I started to go to college, maybe post-17, we had a lot of traumatic things happen in our family. And I think once one of my sisters got ill and just so many things happened. His brothers had all passed away at young ages. He not ran out of people to be close with, but he was so spread out with his energies that he focused on, I have a son. And we just started to talk more, which was something that happened organically. And I guess parents and children, they bond at different times in their relationship. Or in the case of my kids, we've always been close, but we're closer now than we were when they were little.
We've got a clip of your 2007 HBO special called "That Ain't Right."
Can you run any of it?
Yeah, there's just a whole musical series of beeps that we'll enjoy, and the beeps, if you listen to it backwards, it sounds like Wagner. But
that's a nice idea, because every F bomb, it is a rim shot of its own kind.
All right, so let's listen to "That Ain't Right."
Oh, let us pray.
I was kidding with my dad, and my dad, we lost my dad. Actually, my mom let go of the curly cord at the mall, and it's a horrible joke. He was a great guy, and he's no longer with us. And in fact, give my dad a big round of applause. He was a funny mother, and he was. I said that to him once. I said, "You're a funny mother." He goes, "That's right, I your mother." It's like, oh my God. Shut up, you dirty bastard. He's like, "No, you're a dirty bastard. She's not your mother." He was adorable. Even near the end, my mother was like, they were in their 80s, and my dad was like, your dad and I are still sexually active. We're still active. I'm like, shut the f*** up. I don't want to know that. My dad's like, "If your mom and I are having sex and we videotape it and she falls out of bed funny, can I win $10,000? I'm like, oh, shut up, old man. He was, he's the reason I do this.
That was,
certainly doesn't sound as respectful as it was intended.
No, not from what we heard. But you did say your dad had a great sense of humor. You think there's a genetic component?
I do. I was raised by his survival type of humor. And he just would always have a smirk and always have something funny to say. It wasn't always wordplay. It wasn't always a pun. Just a really sharp, sweet man. Very, very sweet man. It's the apple doesn't fall far from the stump.
You said, though, that when you were in kindergarten, you liked to make girls laugh.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, girls laughed at me in kindergarten, too. But
what kindergarten did you go to?
Oh, I went to Friends School in Atlantic City, New Jersey, with Teacher Betty.
Wow.
Yeah.
I went to Friends with no benefits. It was in
You're not kidding.
None. Zero. I would, on a short bus to Hebrew school, I would try to make girls laugh, and it worked occasionally. But I was not, and I was living in Norfolk, Virginia at the time when I was very young. I had left Philly for a while and then moved there because of the supermarket business. But it's interesting, and the thing that this memoir, whatever it is I've written, Dirty Daddy, it's got a two-edged title to it. It's not just lascivious. It also deals with him being a strong part of my life. And he really, he did such strange things. When I remember I was depressed. I was 17 years old. I was living in my parents' apartment in Northeast Philly. And I walked into my room one night. It was late at night. And my dad had taken an eggplant, just an eggplant from the market, and wrapped it in a towel, like a little babushka around its head, and put it under the covers, and then a big note next to it in block lettering that said, "Bob, I waited up for you." And it wasn't a joke. It was just peculiar behavior. And if that had happened all the time, I would have called the authorities. But it was like a one time, "We can make a vegetable funny before you go to bed, son. Have a good night."
You know, you alluded to all the loss and tragedy you experienced over the years. You know, your parents lost 4 out of 5 children.
Yes.
Over the course of lifetime.
So difficult, so terrible that they went through that.
You said that your family, over the years, they were waiting for the next tragedy to arrive.
Yeah, we were always waiting for the next shoe to drop, so to speak. It was a nightmare. And the two children they lost before me, a hospital in Philly had dysentery, so about 8 babies passed away. And they were full-term twins, born to the same day I was born, 2 years before me. And that was so traumatic for them. But they moved forward, and they felt they had a positive energy, which is just impossible, and something, a lot of bravery. And I guess part denial and then part of just sheer human drive to move on. And then my other two sisters, one was Andy, and she died at 34 of a brain aneurysm. And then Gay died of scleroderma 20 years ago. She was 47 years old. And I'm active in the Scleroderma Research Foundation. I'm on the board. And
How can we find out about Scleroderma Research Foundation? Where do we look that up?
That is on srfcure.org.
Okay.
srfcure.org. And we're actually doing a benefit Wednesday in San Francisco. I'm doing it. Train is going to perform, and Jeff Garland and Dana Carvey, and I host the benefits. We're doing one in Vegas. The closest we get to Philly will be in New York. We'll do it in November. And we raised over $30 million in money and that we give right to research.
I wonder about what impact this had on you. You know, you alluded to your depression. You just said when you were 17. You talked about when you were deeply depressed when you moved to L.A. by yourself at 22 to try to make it out there. What kind of depression was this? Was it sadness or was it clinical depression? Were you able to function?
I wasn't clinically depressed. I wasn't medicated except for I moved here in the early 80s and working in comedy clubs. So there were substances around, but they weren't prescribed.
Ah. Yeah. Unfortunately, they work very well.
They got people through the nights, and then some people didn't survive them, and some people just used them socially. And it was a very difficult time in general because I was a struggling comedian in L.A. for about 7-8 years. I was depressed for about 7-8 years because it's a very hard thing to make it in any business. But if you come out to L.A. and your dream is to be a director and an actor and a comedian and all these things. I used to have on a card that said, "And stereo repair," because there were so many things listed. But the depression was something that I was no stranger to, and I became friendly with most comedians have a darkness to them, and they see things as an outsider. Mine came from being an outsider because of moving a whole lot, never really having a place to live for a very long time, and a lot of loss all the time. So you don't become attached emotionally as much, or you're looking for love if you can.
I guess what struck me about depression is I've experienced depression 3 times in my life. I can't imagine being funny or trying to be funny
Right.
When I'm in the midst of a depression. I
wish you would have called me. I could have helped you.
Really?
Not really. I was probably too depressed. I had a birthday. I remember I was 29. I had just I'd been married a couple years before. I was with my friend Dave Coulier and his girlfriend at the time, and it was my birthday, and I never thought I'd work again. I had just done a Richard Pryor movie, and then the phone didn't ring for 6 months after that, and it was before I wound up on a show on CBS on some morning show before I did Full House. And I was so depressed for so long because everybody was moving on that I worked with out at the Comedy Store and getting their own shows, and just not founded in anything rational, because nobody has anything to do with you anyway. But I wish my 57-year-old self could have told my 29-year-old self that. And Dave, it was so depressive that Dave was such a good friend, and he put a cake in front of me that said crappy buttocks instead of happy birthday. And it was just a butt with candles in it. And it was, and they sang crappy buttocks to me instead of happy birthday. I have a picture of that cake. It was sad. And anybody trying to make it in anything, especially, you know, coming out to L.A. or New York, if you want to be in theater, or anything anybody wants to do seems just impossible unless it happens quickly. And then,
right.
And if it happens quickly at a young age, then the id takes over, and then right. There's got to be a downfall after that, unless you've somehow figured out how hedge funds work. So,
I want to pick up something you mentioned in your book, Bob. You said the one thing you love about yourself is that you want to help keep people alive. What's that mean to you?
That I want to help people, I'm sorry.
Keep people alive.
Keep people alive, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, because I passed away on you while you were saying that.
No, that's okay. I put on my psychotherapist voice, and you just can't
it
hear
does. It. It calms me down. You get me in a very lucid state.
I apologize for that.
No, it's helpful. It starts my day well. I don't deal well with people passing away, and no one does. And I don't really have a job that is medical, you know. In some ways, as valuable as you'd like to say, giving people joy, entertaining them, making them laugh, you know, it's not a life changer. Sometimes you can inspire someone and give them advice maybe that helps change their path, but it's pretty, compared to certain things like flying an airplane, getting people somewhere, or operating on the brain, comedian is not high up on the list.
Oh, wait a minute. If you can tune in to the second half of the show, where we're having a cognitive neuroscientist who's going to talk about what laughter does to the brain, and it really can alter over time. It can really alter your perspective, your worldview.
Is it serotonin that's getting released?
Dopamine.
See, I've dated both of them.
All right. Now listen.
Serotonin had a much more positive attitude. Dopamine didn't. She didn't know what was going
well,
on.
Well, listen. You've already screwed up this interview. Don't screw up the next interview.
I won't. I'll listen. God. I'll listen much more attentively.
Goodness.
But yes, I don't. I like to bring whatever joy I can in a non. It sounds so sarcastic, but it's not. A friend of mine last night asked me to bring an 8x10 with me because there's a 6-year-old boy who's got days to live, and the kid loved Full House, so he wanted me to bring a picture. And I said to him, "How dare you?" No, that's not what I said. That's the gallows humor. I said, "Can I meet the kid?" And so today I'm going to do some out in the world in L.A., some stuff, and I'm going to try to go see the kid, whatever the hospital he's in. But that's the tragedy of a life that hasn't been realized. And
yeah.
If you can bring a moment of as artificial as it might seem, if it's not, if it's a moment of joy for someone, it does make me feel like I'm not just a worthless person who's been tap dancing on a floor for people and trying to get applause. It gives some worth.
Oh, Bob, We gotta talk, fella. We gotta talk.
Are you a licensed medical practitioner?
I'm a licensed psychologist, not medical. I'm a licensed psychologist. So, you know.
But if I needed the Heimlich while I was talking to you, you could possibly help me there too.
You're screwed. You're screwed.
Well, at least I'll go out with peace of mind.
So listen, I know you got to go. I just want to say before you I say goodbye to you. I know you're going to Australia for the first time next month, and I also know that you've recently lost your mother, Dolly. So because I am 10 years your senior, I want to take this opportunity to tell you a couple things. So
Okay. Make
sure you leave a photocopy of your passport at home. Make sure you get up and walk on the airplane so you don't have anything with your blood circulation. And don't eat any food that looks weird, and stay away from strangers.
To basically just be in my own little bubble, and I'll be safe.
Exactly.
I'm going to wrap myself. I'm going to dip myself in paraffin.
That's better.
Well, I appreciate the advice. I'm going to use some of it, I think.
Good. All right, Bubba.
Well, thank you for talking to me. You centered me for my whole day. And I hope the second half is as exciting as the first half of this interview.
I hope so, too.
Well, it was nice to talk to you.
Bob Sager, it was great talking to you. Thanks so much for the time, and enjoy your time with that little boy.
Thank you.
Take care.
And I'm going to keep calling you the rest of the day, like, what about Bob, if that's okay?
Just send your credit card along, and it'll be fine.
Okay, as long as we understand our relationship.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Take good care of you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a 60-second break, of course. That was Bob Saget, a comedian who we all remember as the TV dad Danny Tanner from Full House. His memoir that he's just written is called Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a Family Man Turned Filthy Comedian. When we get back, we're going to be speaking with Scott Weems. He's a psychologist, cognitive neuroscientist, and author of the book, Ha! The Science of When and Why We Laugh. If you'd like to join that conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Wan Institute supports WHYY. They're a graduate school offering acupuncture and herbal medicine in Glenside and in Hahnemann Hospital. They have both faculty and student clinics. Details at woninstitute.edu.
Temple Beth Zion Beth Israel supports WHYY and announces its inaugural lecture on Jewish thought and psychoanalysis entitled Freud, Moses, and the Holocaust, Sunday, April 27th at 4 p.m. Noted historian and professor Dr. Eli Zaretsky will explore the relationship between Eastern European Jewish culture, the unconscious, the Holocaust, and the prevalence of Jewish psychiatrists and psychologists. Registration at bzbi.org and at jewishthoughtandpsychoanalysis.com.
Supporting WHYY, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about humor. And we've got with us now Dr. Scott Weems, a psychologist, cognitive neuroscientist. He's written a delightful, very readable book called Ha! The Science of When and Why We Laugh. Scott, welcome to the show. Do we have you?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, thank you very much for having me.
All right, you dozed off for a minute there.
I think I just got that connected in.
No, I thought you fell asleep because the other interview was so boring. All right, so listen. You get this idea to take your career as a cognitive scientist and turn it 45 degrees to examine humor. That makes sense to me. What I need to explore with you is that you came up with the idea to write a book about humor during the final scene of the Titanic. So this begs the question, what the hell's wrong with you?
What's wrong with me? And to be fair, what's wrong with my wife, who was the one who broke out in laughter at the end of Titanic? And everybody else was crying. I'm sure everybody remembers the scene where Leonardo DiCaprio is drowning, and you know the ship is obviously sunk. And I look over to my wife, and she's laughing, and she's doing the best to hold it in. And my parents are there, so it's awkward. And then she whispers in my ear, "Yo, Adrian." The line from Rocky III, I guess it was, or whatever, where he meets Adrian out in the snow, and I just that immediately made me wonder. I've got to know why we laugh. Why is humor? I mean, why is it so much broader than just standard jokes?
I every time though, the idea of humor comes up, you know, and I love humor, but every time. The idea of doing a show on it, I get nervous because the idea of examining humor just can't be very funny, you know, to deconstruct it.
Yeah, me too. I was very nervous about that too. I mean, there's a great line by E.B. White. He said, deconstructing humor is like dissecting frogs. In the end, the product always dies. And I think that's true. And so I wanted to, instead of deconstruct humor and, like, understand what is a joke, and it can be very dry dissecting a joke, I'm a lot more interested in what happens in our minds. Why are we, as a species, just so in love with humor, and what does it mean psychologically? Because even though dissecting a joke might not be interesting, I think humor has so much to do with intelligence and creativity and these broader things that we're all interested in. I think that's much more interesting, and so that's the approach I decided to take.
Is humor partly about making people laugh almost against their will?
There is. There's a certain violation to it, isn't there? That, yeah, if someone knows it's coming, they'll kind of fight it, and you're kind of pushing them towards it. I think if humor is a very social thing, that, yeah, there's a relationship that's going on between the joke teller and receiver. But, I mean, I think more than that, I think it's that we don't laugh at just jokes. We laugh all the time at very strange and awkward moments. And I think it's that wanting to laugh but sometimes not wanting to laugh at the same time that really gives us the healthiest humor.
Hmm. Comedian Tracy Morgan was recently interviewed by the New York Times, and he said a stand-up's job is to hold a mirror to society and look at what we're afraid of. He cited shows like All in the Family and The Jefferson that really addressed these issues head on, like issues of racism. And at the time, and hopefully now, that was right on this country's mind, but so difficult to talk about for so many.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And you look at, like, Chris Rock. I mean, he's done great. And most of his, or a lot of his humor, is about racism. And he speaks so personally and clearly about it. I mean, there's a saying that if you want to make a point, tell a story. But if you want to make more than one point at once, tell a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you're doing when you're being humorous. There's the overt message, but then there's usually the subtleties involved too, and it's the subtleties that allow you to get away with saying something that I don't know if you can always say so directly.
So let's get to that. Your point is very apropos. We've got a clip here from Margaret Cho. She's being interviewed on the Mortified Sessions on the Sundance Channel. For those who don't know her, she's of Korean ancestry. She's openly bisexual and known for her stand-up routines, so through which she critiques social, political problems, especially those pertaining to race and sexuality. And to our listeners, this is not going to be raunchy. This is funny. Let's listen to this clip.
Yeah, this is me and my brother Han, who lucked out and had the coolest name you could have in the 70s.
In the 70s, right.
Han, yeah. After Star Wars came out. His name's Han. I was born with a different name. My Korean name is Moran. which spelled in English M-O-R-A-N, which is the worst name you can have as a kid. And then my parents, they're
like, that's going in third grade.
Well, yeah, it's horrible. And like all my parents were trying to do was give me like this poetic name, but they didn't have enough of a grasp of English to understand that's not the name I should have.
Right.
So that had something to do with it. Moran, it's like, I think that the other immigrant kids were rejecting their own foreignness.
They could at least point to you and like, but we're not like her.
Yeah, because I was so much of an FOB, you know. I was so foreign, you know, because my lunches always had some kind of squid arm coming out. Like there was some
kind of PB&J with the crest cut off.
No, there was everything
Capri
had
Sun.
Eyes.
So there's Margaret Cho, and she's being playful about the immigrant experience, but what she's also doing is humanizing the experience of immigrants.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think she probably did she's done quite well because she's learned to take these very awkward moments that we've all had in childhood. I mean, hers sound very, very difficult. I can't imagine growing up with that name. But that said, she's taken that moment in her life and she's laughed at it. And so many moments like that, you've got two choices. You can either laugh or you can cry. And, I mean, laughing has far more benefit. So if you can make a joke out of it and if you can laugh about it, that's a very healthy thing.
So what happens in our brains, Scott, when we laugh unexpectedly?
So as you told Bob Saget, it's about dopamine.
I got that from your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so really what happens in our brain is usually during humor, it's a matter of conflict. And conflict isn't a bad thing. Conflict is actually just whatever we experience, any time that we think we know what's going on, but we actually don't. So you build up some sort of expectation, and then you're shocked out of it. And the brain deals with that all the time. That's why we laugh at a lot more than just jokes. We all the time expect something and get something else. And so when you work through that conflict, the brain enjoys that. It enjoys discovering new things and going new places. So that's an enjoyable thing. And that enjoyment comes in the form of, as you said, dopamine, which is essentially the brain's reward chemical.
So what you're saying is our funny bone is somewhere in our brain.
It is. It's the anterior cingulate, without being too technical. This is the part of the brain. It's not on the surface, a little below. And it's essentially our conflict detector. And it's active for pretty much all kinds of humor and other things, too.
Oh, that's the beginning of a joke. You know, a guy and his anterior cingulate go into a bar together.
Yeah, it just flows off the tongue.
We can look at some of the old comedians like Groucho Marx, for example, or one of the best comedy routines for my money ever recorded, and that's Who's On First with Abbott and Costello. Let's listen to that.
Well, let's see. Now, we have on our team, we have Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
That's what I want to find out, the guy's name. That's what I want to find out, the guy's name.
I'm telling you, Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
Now, Abbott, you want to be the manager of the baseball team?
Yes.
You know the guy's names?
Well, I should.
Well, you tell me the guy's names on the baseball team.
I say, Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
You ain't saying nothing to me yet. Go ahead and tell me.
I'm telling him.
You ain't said nothing yet. Go ahead and tell me.
Who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, is on third.
You know the guy's names on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
I still laugh when I hear that. And you know, I've heard it hundreds of times at Cooperstown, the Baseball Hall of Fame. There's a room devoted to this. It just plays over and over and over again, and I watch people sit on a bench, kids sit on the bench, and they still laugh. What's happening? What makes that so damn funny?
So I guess too. First, I love it too. Of course, that's clearly a classic. I guess I have two answers. On one level, you always get nervous deconstructing a joke. You know, I hate to break it apart too much and understand it because you do a little lose a little bit of the grace. But at the same time, I think you can look at that and go, well, there's a lot of conflict going on there. I mean, the listener has figured it out pretty quickly, but obviously, I guess it was Abbott's the one that hasn't figured it out, right? And so there's you got a lot of contradictions going on between the names and the other meanings. And I think part of the reason it's funny, too, is they speak it and they go through it so fast that you don't have time to really think about it too much. They're just it's rapid fire. And so you've got a lot of stuff going on very quickly. We're just barely able to keep up, and clearly one of the people in the conversation isn't able to keep up.
Right. We reminds me of a show we recently did on stress contagion, and there's also giggling contagion. I remember when I was a little kid, I would get Mad Magazine. I don't even know if that's still published, but I got Mad Magazine. There was a tiny little plastic 45, and was just 10 minutes of giggling, just giggling. There was no words, and I laughed my little 10-year-old butt off every time I listened to that.
Yeah, I mean, laughter is very contagious, and you can see this scientifically, too. There have been studies where people have been put in rooms with laughing people and under various circumstances and controls, and yeah, just being around somebody laughing makes us laugh, which is why we often laugh when we greet new people and do these kind of awkward social introductions, is because it's gotten to be like a social cue. The only exception is if someone's laughing and you think they're trying to trick you into laughing, then that kind of falls apart a little bit, which is, I think, why shows are using laugh tracks a little bit less frequently now, television shows, than they used
mm-hmm.
to. Because if you think someone's trying to trick you, then we rebel. We're hard-headed that way. So
yeah, that's pretty annoying. Let's go to the phones. We've got Barb on the line. Hi, Barb. Hi, Barb.
Hey, Dr. Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
You're talking about something that's near and dear to my heart. On Monday mornings, 10 a.m., faithfully, I go to laughter yoga. And it's forced laughter. It's exercises. I mean, in between each exercise, we go, very good, very good, yay! It's just forced laughter, which I understand has some of the same positive effects as real laughter, which is why I'm doing it.
Ah, so has it affected your mood?
Absolutely, absolutely. However, and as you know, Dr. Dan, I'm going through some things with some aging parent issues, and I could not even force myself to go this morning because the idea of forcing myself to laugh was so difficult that I just said, I can't do it.
And
I was afraid that my laughter would actually turn to tears.
Well, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. So Scott, what's happening in the brain, first of all, with forced laughter?
Yeah. First, I think laughter yoga, great. I've heard so much about it since the book came out, and it seems such a great idea. And you do get a lot of great benefits in the brain and throughout the body when you do that laughter. And I don't actually call it fake laughter or forced. I mean, you're forcing it a little bit, but it's the same kind of laughter as you would get ordinarily. I mean, depending on how much joy accompanies it, you know, that really depends on the joke or whatever's making you laugh. But when you laugh, studies have shown that you get a lot of heart benefits, so you get better improved blood pressure. You get better immune system function. There's actually something called natural killer cells, which attacks things like cancer and viruses. And being exposed to humor and laughing has been shown to improve this immune system response. See, there's a lot of good things. Plus, it's just good exercise. I mean, it's cardiovascular exercise, too.
Well, then people should laugh at my stupid jokes more. We gotta take a short break. We're talking with Scott Weems, a cognitive neuroscientist. He's written Ha, The Science of When and Why We Laugh. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM. I don't hear it.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
One of my favorite comedy groups, Monty Python, which is silly. It's just plain silly. You talked about that. You talked about a link between humor and political beliefs.
There is a link. It's a little indirect, but it's still pretty important. That I was mentioning before, the anterior cingulate, which is the part of the brain that detects conflict and that's so important for humor. Well, it turns out that people with more liberal beliefs have larger anterior cingulates. So these are individuals who, this might say, are maybe better tuned or have brains that are especially good at dealing with conflict or confusion or working through the complexities of a problem. And in contrast, it turns out the people with greater conservative beliefs, they have larger amygdala, which some people might have heard of. This is the brain center largely responsible for emotion. Fear is one of those emotions, but other emotions too. And so it might be that people who are more conservative-minded use emotion more in their decision-making. And I wouldn't say either approach is bad, because without either, if we didn't have both an amygdala and an anterior cingulate, then we wouldn't have humor. But they're two very different ways of looking at things.
I want to talk about, we talked earlier about social commentary, and you mentioned Chris Rock. So I want to, my way of thanking you for mentioning that is, we're going to play a clip from Chris Rock, because he's really on the other end of comedy from Groucho Marx or Abbott and Costello. You know, the very popular comedy now is the cutting edge stuff. You know, maybe started with Don Rickles, and today the likes of Bob Saget, Lewis Black, in my opinion, riotously funny. But let's listen to this clip of Chris Rock.
You don't need no gun control. You know what you need? We need some bullet control. We need to control the bullets. That's right. I think all bullets should cost $5,000. $5,000 for a bullet. You know why? Because if a bullet costs $5,000, there'll be no more innocent bystanders. The end. Every time somebody gets shot, you'll be like, damn, he must have did something. Put $50,000 worth of bullets in his ass. And people will think before they kill somebody if a bullet costs $5,000. Man, I would blow your head off if I could afford it. I'm gonna get me another job, I'm gonna start saving some money, and you a dead man. You better hope I can't get no bullets on layaway. So even if you get shot by a stray bullet, you won't have to go to no doctor to get it taken out. Whoever shot you will take their bullet back. I believe you got my property.
You gotta love Chris Rock doing this. I mean, you just, this is a very serious commentary about gun control. And it was funny as hell.
And he's making a point. I mean, I think it wouldn't be funny if there wasn't a real message there, too. And that's, he's an expert at that, obviously. He can make any topic worthy of laughter. And I think that's a good thing, because he's really tackling these issues. And, I mean, any issue that's really prominent at the time, this is a great topic for humor. I mean, I start my book with Lenny Bruce, who in, you know, 50s and 60s was a great comedian. And you've got Chris Rock, and then now you've got even comedians like Amy Schumer is a great mm-hmm. female comedian. Now she's tackling, you know, what's it like to be a female comedian? These are all, it's, in my mind, it's all basically genius in different forms.
Hmm. I got an eye on the clock, and there's something I really want to get to. And, you know, I wondered about, you know, whether we all have a sense of humor, whether we're all drawn to it. But I wonder if that's the case with all mammals. I swear my dog sometimes rolls her eyes at me. I swear that's what's going on.
Yeah, I might go out on a limb. I'm not sure everybody agrees with me, but I think a lot of people do. That not only do all animals laugh, and we have good evidence of that, but I think animals do have senses of humor. We'll never know what it's like to be a dog or a chimpanzee or these other animals. We can't know. They're just so different than us. But that said, there have been a lot of scientists who have observed laughter in these animals. Even rats laugh.
Wait a minute. Rats yep. laugh.
So rats laugh.
I when I read that, I had this image of this poor schlub graduate student sitting in a tiny little room with a bunch of rats and a microphone.
No, it's much more fun than that. I'm so lucky. I interviewed Jeffrey Bergdorf, who's basically the rat tickler. And he works in Chicago. And rat tickling is much more active and fun than that. It's kind of a form of play. They'll kind of fall on their back, and it's very vigorous, tickling a rat is. I actually have a training video, which is one of the most, that was probably the most fun thing I did in researching the book, is speaking to him and learning how he tickles rats. And it sounds trivial at first, but it's not, because if you can understand what makes a rat laugh, then you're on the way to making hypotheses of what make people laugh. And he specifically studies depression. And
so you turn us on our bellies and on our backs and tickle our bellies.
Yeah, not that different than a baby, I guess. You know, I guess rats are that's what they like.
You know, you're a psychologist and you're recommending this on the public airwaves here.
Yeah, well, I had rats as a child in my old science experiments, and I was never brave enough to do it because they bit quite a bit, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I would say definitely be careful if you try that at home.
Or if you try it with your friends or family, too.
Yeah, email me through the website. I'll send you the training video and so you can be safe.
I wonder about humor by gender. You said that women laugh twice as much as men, but really, isn't most of their laughter about us?
Yeah, this is a fascinating difference we have, because it turns out that women laugh more than men, as you said, and we know because scientists have gone out in the field and just eavesdropped on people, and, you know, coffee shops and subway stations and who knows where. And yeah, women laugh more than men. And so trying to understand that is why that is odd. Because on one hand, there are fewer professional female comedians than males. That's unfortunate, but I think it's about 12% female. But if you look at the brains of people as they're like listening or watching humor, it turns out that women's brains are not less active. They're actually more active during humor. So, you know, if you give a woman a joke that's not quite that funny, they'll actually work harder to make sense of it. And so the one theory is, and I'm not sure how much I believe it, but it makes some sense, is that women kind of are raised, or maybe there's a evolutionary component to it, but very likely were raised, to be more the audience.
Well, and that,
males have to make them laugh to show their suitability.
And that's the way it is. Listen, you and I have both tried our hand at humor, and I don't know how yours worked out, but I've got a clip of a partial clip of mine. This is a preview. Let's listen. So, you know, we're having a conversation, and a nurse walks in. She's wearing a nurse's smock with these beautiful colors, these Southwest colors of turquoise and brown. So I commented about how great the colors were. And she says, oh, yeah. Yeah, she said, my whole house is in these colors. And I say to myself, And then she says, yeah, one day God came to me and said, buy paint. Well, listen, As a psychotherapist with 40 years' experience, I know exactly what to do. I nod my head like a bobblehead doll. I look pensive, and I say, oh. Ordinarily, I charge a lot of money for that. Oh. But this time I didn't. So, I said to Joan after she left, I said, now, that ticked me off. She said, why? I said, I'm an upstanding member of my synagogue. I pay my dues. I even was on the board for a little while. I've honored almost half of the Ten Commandments. And despite that, God never told me to buy paint. Okay, so we had a laugh. A couple of weeks later, I'm out of the hospital. I pick up the phone, and I call Joan. I said, Joan, I got great news. She said, what? I said, God called me. He said, buy paint. And Joan says, well, what color? I said, that was my next question. I said, dear God, what color paint? And Joan said, so what do you say? I said, God, tell me what color. And God said, whatever. So that was a clip of my monologue. If you want to hear the whole monologue in its entirety, and I don't know why you would, but if you do, go to our website. We're at whyy.org/voices. Well, Scott, I want to really thank you so much for joining us today. And I loved our discussion. I loved the opportunity to be playful with you. And I loved your book. It's called Ha! The Science of When and Why We Laugh. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, as you know, we've been talking about laughter with Bob Saget and Scott Weems. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about civil rights, what's being taught, moreover, what's not being taught to our children. Well, to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. You can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And reach me. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. You can find information about my book or upcoming lectures. And just a reminder, Bob Saget's book is called Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a Family Man Turned Filthy Comedian. It was a great read. Well, the engineer on today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please, please, have fun this week.
You're listening to